Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. I should say good morning, New Mexico. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are moving up the dial so we can reach more of northern New Mexico. We're at 101.1 FM. We're simulcasting with 90.7 FM, but 101.1 FM is our new home. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen any time of the day thanks to Santa Fe's Dot Foil Computer Services. And you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Helen Malanfi, who is a professor of criminal justice, and she is going to be talking about restorative justice, which is a new approach to punishment. We're also going to be talking to Frida Arth of the New Mexico Women's Foundation about the Rag Rug Festival coming up. Right now, I'd like to welcome Chandler Liberty. She is with the Santa Fe Fashion Designers. Welcome.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Excellent. Thank you.
What is the Santa Fe Fashion Designers?
Santa Fe Fashion Designers is a relatively new nonprofit that we formed at the beginning of the year of 2006 to support and promote the fashion industry in Santa Fe specifically, but New Mexico generally.
Nonprofit and fashion design don't necessarily...
I guess you could look at it as a trade organization. So that's it has a strong educational component, and that's where the nonprofit part really comes into play.
So what kind of design do we have going on in New Mexico? Does it all have a southwestern feel?
It really does not. There is a surprising number of independent designers in Santa Fe. I swear every week I hear of a new designer that I was not familiar with. And most of them are not doing broomstick skirts.
But you are doing, for example, Virgin of Guadalupe jeans.
I am, and I guess that is definitely the New Mexico influence coming into play in my particular and personal design world. But it runs a very broad gamut from very cutting-edge contemporary design to very classic and tailored traditional garments.
What is the market for? I mean, this is obviously a more high-end kind of thing than what you're going to buy at Ross Dress for Less.
Yes, definitely. A lot of people are doing custom clothing, or they're doing limited-run productions. We've got Robin Beechner over at Sense, who's doing just lovely, she calls it leisure wear and vacation wear and yoga wear. And her stuff is really incredible. And then we're also...
So if you go on a leisurely yoga vacation, you're all set.
There you go. Here you can come to Santa Fe and do all your shopping first and then head out on the road. And we're also including accessory designers, which includes jewelry and handbags and scarves and anything that falls under fashion accessories category.
So you are doing today what's called a trunk show. I hear that word all the time. What is a trunk show? Everybody opens the back of your cars and you stand in the parking lot?
Traditionally, yes.
Really?
Yeah, that's where the term comes from, is people would literally sell out of the trunks of their cars. Today it is more... that a space has been set aside and designers are able to bring their goods and set up and then sell in a common location.
And today that is at Quail Run from 2 to 4.
Exactly.
Is the public invited to that? Can people just show up?
People can RSVP still. It is being hosted by Susan Burke, and we're honoring a designer named Barbara Grimes, who does custom order, really high-end Western-influenced garments. She sells to a lot of the country and western singers. And you can call an RSVP still to Susan Burke at 603-5646.
And we can't mention prices, but 603-5646 is the number you can call. It's a very low admission fee to get into this. So this is a trunk show, but normally, where do New Mexico fashion designers, Santa Fe fashion designers, sell their work?
That is one of the things that we're trying to address through the organization, is that a lot of us are not represented in retail organizations. I personally, for my line, sell directly to clients, and I just have a workspace. Some of the designers are represented in the local neighborhood boutiques, and we're trying to expand that relationship between Santa Fe Fashion Designers as an organization and the boutique owners so that there is more accessibility to the local designers.
It's sort of like trying to get local food markets to carry local produce.
Exactly. And ultimately, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, we see maybe that the Santa Fe Fashion Designers will have its own retail establishment through which member designers can sell, but that's off in the future. We've got very big plans for the organization And at this point, though, since it's only a year and a half old, we're still very much in growing stages.
What are some of your very big plans?
Right now, we're a virtual organization. We don't have a location. And one of the things is eventually to have a location. One of the bees in my bonnet is to get group rate health insurance for members. We're also working with the Santa Fe Opera and forming a relationship with them to further an educational component again, because they've been looking for ways to get into the community and spread some of their resources into the community, and we may become their vehicle for doing that.
What's the difference between designing for regular clothing and designing, for example, for theater or dance, things that you've done?
It's very different. I mean, I've done a little bit of both. I did all the shirts for the Broadway production of Annie Get Your Gun, which was very exciting. I did all the men's shirts. We were able to get away with basically men's dress shirts in a Western style. But if you're doing specifically for dance or theater where there are quick costume changes, the costume has to be reused for other actors and actresses down the road, and if there's a tremendous amount of movement involved, the construction details need to be different because the garments need to be more flexible. They need to be able to move with the body. And in the future, the garment needs to be easily altered for a different size performer. So it's definitely different. There are a lot of different techniques, but there's a lot of, overlap also.
Are you concerned with, for example, using organic clothing, using organic fabrics and things like that, and non-chemical dyes? I mean, the whole sort of healthy living where it comes to clothing?
We definitely have some designers. There's a gal named Crystal here who has a clothing line called Conscious Clothing, and her garments are all organic silk hemp blends, and that is definitely one of her points for her clothing line. It varies per designer.
When you make, for example, a pair of Virgin Guadalupe jeans, how many do you make in a run?
Everything's custom. I do one piece at a time.
And is that typical for fashion designers? Every piece is custom?
Oh, definitely not. I'm probably the exception to the rule. I mean, most people... I mean, again, there are a number of custom clothiers here in Santa Fe, but then there are a lot of people that are doing small production runs. But most of that, unfortunately, we do not have a production facility in New Mexico. I believe there's a company in Albuquerque that does small runs. But in terms of major production, most of that is handled. I know even Robin at Sense, her mass production work is done outside of New Mexico, but it is done in the United States.
Chandler Liberty is with Santa Fe Fashion Designers, and once again today from 2 to 4 at Quail Run is a trunk show. Where, how many designers will be there?
We will have 8 garment designers and 4 jewelry designers.
And if anybody wants to go to that, you do have to RSVP, so do it this morning. The number is 603-5646. And Chandler, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
We're going to take a little break and be talking to Frieda Arth in just a moment. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Frieda Arth. She is the president of the board of the New Mexico Women's Foundation, and we're here, as we are every year, this is becoming a tradition, to talk about the Rag Rug Festival that's happening this coming weekend. Welcome.
The fifth year, Mary Charlotte.
Is
amazing.
This the fifth year? And
this
I've only been doing
year.
It for 4 years.
Yeah, so. I was here once before you.
So Friday, August 10th, they're unrolling the Rag Ribbon Ball at the grand opening preview, and then the Rag Rug Festival is happening this weekend on Museum Hill. Was this whole thing your brainchild?
It was.
Tell us about it. How did it all start out?
Well, as you know, New Mexico Women's Foundation helps women throughout the state set up cottage industries. And one of the really basic cottage industries I discovered when I first arrived in New Mexico was the fact that there are women making clothing and rugs out of rags, the ultimate recycling venture.
And meaning old t-shirts, old shirts,
whatever. Most will draw the line at underwear.
Thank
they
you
won't
very
do
much.
Underwear or tennis shoes. But almost
thank
everything else.
Dog.
Yes. So, I couldn't imagine a more charming idea. And it brings to mind immediately everybody's grandmother Everybody remembers a grandmother making a rag rug. The difference in New Mexico is that the rugs are generally woven instead of braided and sewn together. And so they resemble very high-end rugs.
Now, you need a loom to do this.
You do need a loom when you weave. You don't need a loom to make a rag rug, though. You can make them, and you can crochet them, you can braid and sew them together, or obviously, if you weave them, you need a loom. And you need different size looms for different size rugs.
So what happened? You were sitting around thinking about how can we do cottage industries, and you said, I know, I will provide looms to random women all over New Mexico.
Well, you know, not quite that way, but it turns out that many of the groups that we support that are supported by New Mexico Women's Foundation do just that. They will get a room and start filling it with looms and teaching women how to weave and how to make a living. And ultimately, that's our goal, is how do we help women become entrepreneurs?
And this is a tremendous outlet for a lot of these women. Who are these artisans, and how did they find their way into doing this kind of work?
They come from throughout the state. Some of the bigger groups that we work with are in Silver City or Española, Las Cruces. And the festivals, we have three right now, one in Santa Fe in August, one in Farmington in November, and one in Las Cruces in March. The festivals themselves provide product outlets for women who do really almost anything, any kind of service or product that they're making. They can participate in the festivals. The cachet became rag rugs, I mean, because it's such a wonderful image. And more than half of the vendors in our festivals do make rag rugs.
Now, we have a rag rug right here in the Santa Fe Baking Company, which I am holding up to the microphone so that all of you can see it.
As usual.
And it is quite an interesting piece. The designs are often traditional Native American designs. Is that right?
No, this is an exception. This is a Rio Grande style, but they come in every different style. Some women only make very contemporary styles. Some women make very old-fashioned styles like their grandmothers. And a lot of it has to do with what type of materials that they're using. That's often dictates, you know, what style they're going to make and how they're going to produce it to create an image themselves.
Are these works of art that you hang on the wall, or are they rugs that you put on the floor?
Both. I have them both. I have them on the wall, and I have them on my floors. I have some that I just buy because they look terrific. I have one that that was made in 1930, and I have them commissioned as well. I have a wonderful one that I commissioned.
You commissioned it. What did you say?
I want one that looks like this blue wall. And it worked out just great.
We're talking to Frida Arth from the New Mexico Women's Foundation, and the Rag Rug Festival is this Friday through Sunday. How long has it been going on? Is this
the fifth year?
This is the fifth one.
Yeah.
And so have you seen communities actually change, families actually change as a result of the new trade that these women bring to their communities?
I've seen women be able to make a living, almost make a living totally, by being able to produce handmade products. And one of the things that is really important to us, the reason that we work on this all the time, as we do all the board members at New Mexico Women's Foundation, is because we know that if women can stay in their homes, stay in their villages, not have to try to come to Albuquerque or Santa Fe to make a living, they actually can make something. And we often hear that at the festival they will be making a quarter or a third of their income for the year. But keep in mind that 50% of the women in New Mexico are living on between $7,000 and $10,000 a year. So that's why we got involved. That's why we said, well, women have to be able to make a living for their families. And as I said, the cachet popped up of rag rugs to draw attention to this and to help women learn how to do any kind of business that they want to.
Where did they get, and what is your role at the Women's Foundation in teaching the entrepreneurial as opposed to the artisan skills?
We have a program called We Learn, Women Entrepreneurs Learn, And this would probably be known as a technical assistance program in other organizations. It's the way for us to provide free professional help in all aspects of business planning, and particularly in retail. Often the groups that we help will have a gallery or a studio where they sell the products that are made by their members, and they need help in marketing, computers, all sorts of business administration skills that they need to learn. And I often say that we act as a SWAT team. We'll go in on a limited basis and bring professional people in and just spend an entire weekend or two or three days and say, okay, we're going to totally re-merchandise your gallery. We're going to help you learn how to use the equipment that you haven't been using, because there's more to life than just having fun weaving, making handmade things.
And once you do that, is it self-perpetuating?
It is self-perpetuating. We would, let's say we started with a group in Silver City two and a half years ago, who were really just getting started, and now they have a major gallery of their own called the Common Thread. So,
does this depend on tourism and seriously upscale communities in order to function?
No, it doesn't. One of our most successful groups, one of the most successful ones that we work with, is called Tres Manas. And its studio is in a tiny town called San Miguel, about a half hour from Las Cruces. It has a 200-square-foot gallery space in Las Cruces. And it keeps 18 to 20 women employed every day. Every day of the week they come and weave or sew or whatever it is they want to do is with textiles, with fiber arts. And in that respect, it is self-perpetuating. And one of the beauties of this kind of business is that it crosses all cultural and class lines. You'll have women who are retired, who can afford to do it, and you'll have women who are desperate for money.
And they are working together. I mean, it sounds, the way you describe it, it sounds like it's very much of a group activity.
It becomes a group activity. Often, we offer the opportunity for women to work totally at home, but they generally don't want to because they need the support of each other.
We're talking to Frida Arth from the New Mexico Women's Foundation, and once again, the Rag Rug Festival is this weekend. Talk about to what extent this year's Rag Rug Festival is new artisans or returning artisans who've been doing it for the full years, full
it's 5 years.
It's probably
the biggest one we've had. We have 46 booths. We've generally had around 30 booths, and it's a mixture of, I would say, probably a dozen new vendors. The rest of them are returning vendors. It's an important income component, and in Santa Fe, we get the most numbers of people probably, although Las Cruces brings in just about the same amount. In a two-day period, we would have close to 2,000 people coming.
Now, are you saying there's several Rag Rug festivals? How many are there in
there
the state?
There are three. There are three annual ones that we do.
Las Cruces here and
Farmington.
And Farmington.
Yeah.
Does this hark back to weaving traditions that are indigenous to New Mexico, both Native and Spanish?
It does, and I think that's what makes it so successful, is that the beautiful arts and crafts that are produced by both natives and by Spanish-speaking people are really more easily sold, and therefore people are more easily going to make them for that very reason. And our concern is providing product outlets. The Rag Rug festivals are product outlets to us and to them, and we're now opening up many other museum shops throughout New Mexico. I don't know if you realize it, but there are over 200 small museums in New Mexico.
And they all have museum shops.
Well, if they don't, we're going to help them set one up. So it's a wonderful product outlet idea.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, it is.
The shop at the Museum of International Folk Art is one of my favorite things, one of my favorite places in the whole world.
How could you not want to shop in a museum shop? They're absolutely fascinating. I love them.
So you are doing this year also a film festival. Tell us about that. It's Saturday and Sunday.
We tried it out in Las Cruces in March, and it was very well accepted. And these are, we have four films that we'll show the same ones on both days, Saturday and Sunday, when the admission is free to come to the festivals. And the films are about what economic development opportunities there are when people rediscover crafts in various countries, not necessarily just in this country. There is a film by some people in Peru. There's another one in a place called Asangate. And it shows that if you go back to what you already know how to do and can preserve and present those traditions, you often can make a living.
So this is, what is it running throughout the day repeatedly, or is there a specific time that people should come to see those films?
We have a schedule for the films. For instance, at 10:30, there's one called From the Inside Out about Navajo basket making. At 11:30, Asangate will be shown. And these are short films. The first one is 27 minutes. The next one is an hour. The one after that is at 1 o'clock, and it's about a migration idea or a way not to have men migrate to the United States by some women in communities in Mexico that...
Who want to keep them around.
Who want, well, when the men were no longer there, when they were working in the United States, these women rediscovered the things that they could make. And now the men are coming back and saying, oh, if you can make a living at it, we want to come back, because it wasn't all that great when we got here. And then the last one of the day is called Weaving the Future, and it's about an indigenous community in Ecuador who, the theme is similar, that if women want to make something that they already know how to do, they might be able to make a living.
This is a theme that also came up around the folk art market, is women being really the agents of revitalization in communities that are depressed. Why women?
Why are women doing that?
Yeah, why do they tend to be the agents? They're the ones to whom you give micro credit loans. They're the ones who are revitalizing villages.
Well, often it's because women end up being single by themselves, trying to raise a family. Excuse me. And it's often the case that women will have to fill in the gaps. I mean, that's been true since the beginning of time, that when there is a problem, it's a woman who has to come up with the solution. And as our name implies, New Mexico Women's Foundation, our concern is to help women specifically.
So it's all women artisans who are at the Rag Rug Festival?
That's correct.
What are some of the other things besides rag rugs, some of the other products that people are going to be selling?
Oh, dear. Well, Beatrice Sandoval, who's a wonderful artisan who makes colcha, also does fabulous tin work. And we're going to be presenting free workshops by Beatrice. And believe it or not, when men come, they want to know if they can learn how to do punched tin. And so we decided to do that this year.
Is this the first year they've done tin work?
This is the first year we've presented it, yes. We've had other workshops, but generally they've been in fiber arts. This will be the first year we've done this part of it. We have a boutique ourselves where we sell vintage linens that are donated to us, and that's a way for us to make a living. We have two little kids under the age of 12 who are going to be doing their own gift baskets. It's called Kids Made Gift Baskets, and it's a way for us to try to introduce children to doing the same things that their mothers and grandmothers are doing. Art for the Heart is an organization up in Peñasco, and they make a variety of things. In fact, the woman who runs that program, Jean Nichols, has a big motto that says, we can make art out of absolutely anything, and they generally do, and so that's quite fun. There's all sorts of textile arts. I mean, almost everything you possibly can imagine. There's a woman coming for the first time who does loom bead jewelry. She weaves beads to make jewelry, which I think is fascinating. There's a woman coming from San Patricio who has her own berry farm. And so she'll be bringing her jams and jellies. So we have a lot of things represented in these festivals, and besides textile arts, And again, the purpose of the festivals is it is a product outlet, and it is to showcase anything that a woman knows how to make.
Frieda Arthas from the New Mexico Women's Foundation. All of this is happening this weekend. There is a grand opening preview reception and sale on Friday, which you have to pay to get into.
Yes, and then you should call 983-6155 in order to make reservations for that. That's 983-6155.
And then on Saturday and Sunday, it is free to the public from, 10 in the morning till 4 in the afternoon.
It is, and it's very exciting, and it's wonderful to see people streaming up the hill on Museum Hill to come to the Rag Rug Festival, and often you'll find that people have been there all 5 years.
And if you go up Old Santa Fe Trail to Museum Hill and take a right, it'll be quite obvious where it is.
It's a right at Camino Lejo, and there are lots of signs that will direct you.
Frieda Arthas, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
We're going to take a break right now and hear a commentary from Ron Bloomberg. Stay tuned to KSFR.
It's Ron Bloomberg, just the voice in the crowd. Did you see the travel section in Sunday's New York Times? Oh, you get the Cleveland Plain Dealer? Well, if you had read the cover page of the New York Times travel section, you would have been filled with pride. It was a glowing 3-page article on your hometown. The headline read, "Is Santa Fe Ready for a Makeover?" Trust me, it was a rave review about living in Santa Fe. Here are some excerpts from it. The late sun doesn't just gleam on the old adobe edifice. It's deeper than that. The red and orange that lights up the wall seem to come from deep within. There's a moment like this every evening in Santa Fe. And get this. It's a sun-cured, earthy city for seekers and dreamers wanting to heal their dissatisfactions. Yeah, that's what I am, a seeker and a dreamer, and my dissatisfactions are beginning to heal. I no longer care about being movie star handsome or Warren Buffett wealthy. All I dream about now is enjoying a good fajita burrito, and one day, like all my friends, getting a real estate license and serving humanity by selling adobe haciendas to all the millions who will read the New York Times on Sunday and want to live in utopia. Well, I've got to run. I think another thunderstorm is coming, and my roof is leaking, and my swamp cooler is not working, and I have to hitch a ride home, because the potholes on our streets knocked out 2 tires and a shock absorber. But all is well in Santa Fe. Talk to you next week, if you have a minute.
I'd like now to welcome Helen Malanfi. She is a professor of criminal justice at the College of Santa Fe and Santa Fe Community College, and she's teaching a course at Ghost Ranch Santa Fe on restorative justice, a new approach to punishment, in October of this year, which we'll be talking about. Welcome.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte, for having me here.
It's great to have you, and it's a very interesting topic that we've touched on a few times on this program in the past. What is restorative justice, and how is it different from any other kind of justice?
Well, I'd like to say that the title of the workshop is Justice or Just Desserts, and Just Desserts really refers to retributive justice, just pure punishment. Restorative justice says that crime is really a violation of individuals, communities, and relationships. It's not just breaking rules. The Criminal Act breaks the whole balance in our social system. And so to bring back the balance and repair the harm created by the violation, it's necessary to incorporate the needs of individuals, the victim, and the community, and to restore the offender. It emphasizes responsibility, accountability, for the act, and punishment as well, but punishment with a constructive purpose that will lead to rehab and get reintegrating the person back into the community. And while it doesn't deter the first act, the aim of it is to cut down the recidivism rate. So in that sense, it is a preventative approach to criminal justice.
Where does this idea come from? What societies have traditionally used it?
Well, going back, the Aborigines really
in
works
Australia.
With this. In Australia, and even in Canada, they're Native American peoples. And Canada was really the leading nation in the 70s to start to apply this to their own criminal justice system. New Zealand and Australia picked up on it. In the United States, we now have places like Vermont, Colorado, Minnesota, Pennsylvania. In our own state, New Mexico, the juvenile department is using it with minor crimes. And it involves a confrontation, face-to-face mediation between the victim and the offender. And the idea is that in the story being told by the victim, they reach the offender, and the offender gets a sense of really the pain they've caused.
It requires some modicum of empathy in the heart and soul of the offender in order to work.
Absolutely. It has to be a voluntary act on the part of the offender. And they will come, and that they won't be blaming people for what's happened, that they'll be taking accountability for what they did.
I can imagine that in a tribal situation where you have a group of 50 or 100 or 200 people, that would be not only a good choice, but the only choice, because in a tribal group, you don't have jails. You have to deal with every individual in the community, and they are born and raised part of the community. We live in this crazy, complex, gigantic, anonymous, multicultural society. What are some of the problems that come in when you're dealing with a big society and you're trying to do restorative justice?
Well, there is this Victim Offender Mediation Project, VOM, and there's a VOM association, and they really train mediators to do this work. And when we say mediator, it's really a mediator dialogue that's going on. And so it has to be planned very carefully. Got to be sure both sides are ready. The victim's been really given a lot of time to talk privately with the mediator before anything happens. They're sure the offender really wants to do this. They train people. In Pennsylvania, there's an annual conference, and people who are interested, you know, can contact that organization. Popular notion is that the best way restorative justice works is with minor crimes. You know, they're using it with truancy in England, and they've used it with robbery victims.
Truancy.
But the truth is, it can go all the way up to violent crimes. And the state of Texas started a victim advocacy project in the 80s, and that led to a violent crime project. And there's a man there, David Doffler, who is a former Lutheran minister, a football coach, and a mediator of sex crimes. And he has mediated 12 violent crimes, some of them on death row. One woman, Ann Hines, her son was terribly killed by, just ridiculous or terrible act by a drug dealer, just unplanned, sporadic, just should never have happened. And she began to work with this project. And eventually, she decided she would face this man who had killed her son. And he was one of the most violent people in the Texas prison system. But he eventually agreed that he wanted to meet her. And the way David Doffler tells the story is that Ann Hines already had been practicing with other offenders in trying to explain to them what pain they had caused the victim, but also saying, you could change your life around. And she did meet with this man, and the result was that she felt somewhat relieved to know his story, in the sense that his background, and also that it was a total accident. He wasn't torturing her son. And she felt some kind of relief in this. But she also reached out to him, and they continued to correspond, and his violence is cut down considerably in the prison from this. So there's a lot of evidence that when victims can be led to understand, and the offender can be led to understand, and the victim gets some relief from the trauma by confronting.
I think it is so true that when some kind of transaction happens, even just in, for example, two friends who feel one has wronged the other, a conversation about it is so much better than trying to find closure on your own without the help of that other person.
Yeah, it's closure. That's what they feel.
We're talking to Helen Malamphy. She is a professor of criminal justice at the College of Santa Fe and Santa Fe Community College, and she's going to be teaching a course at Ghost Ranch on restorative justice, which is coming up in October. This is four weeks in a row, three weeks in a row, and it's one afternoon each time?
It's three Sundays, and I want to say that it is it's the Santa Fe Ghost Ranch,
right,
where we're having it. And it's a Sunday, October 7th, October 14th, and October 21st. So lunch will be served at 12, and then the workshop will be from 1 to 3.
Who is it for?
Well, we'd like to see a wide group of people from the community come, and it's not designated for professionals in the field or for people who have nothing about or little about the criminal justice system. We're just opening it up to the community.
And so if people are, for example, working in the prison system or in the DA's office or as attorneys or anything
Absolutely.
Like that.
Absolutely.
What is the purpose of it? What are you trying to do?
Well, I want to say that the New Mexico Department of Corrections is actually starting a task force on restorative justice.
Tell us about
that. I've been asked to serve on it. They're going to look at, they have an advisor from Taos, a man who knows a lot about restorative justice, and I think they're going to see what applications there are for wider use in the New Mexico prisons.
I have a friend who works in the prison system, and we were talking about this whole question of forgiveness. Mm-hmm. Forgiveness on some level, I mean, maybe people can't get to victims and families of victims cannot get to a full fullness of forgiveness, or maybe they can, depending on what crime was perpetrated against them or their family. But she was saying, because she works with criminals, that I was asking her what that transaction of forgiveness is like, and she said the hardest transaction of forgiveness is the inmates forgiving their parents and the people who abused them.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Well, there is certainly enough evidence to show that a lot of the most violent people in our society have been themselves abused terribly. I do want to emphasize again that this restorative justice does aim totally at accountability and responsibility on the part of the offender. That's the main thrust. The forgiveness is up to the victim, in
yeah.
a sense.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that takes a long time to come. And it's not necessarily going to happen in a session. But what does happen in these sessions, it seems, is there's some kind of closure for the victim about what happened the night that their loved one was raped or killed in these extreme cases. In the case of the minor victim, like the woman who's robbed by the young teenager, maybe there's some restitution. Maybe the teenager, that's a definite part of the restorative justice principles. Where possible, restitution should be made.
What's an example of the kind of restitution?
Well, it could be some work. If they're on probation, they could do some work for the person, for the victim. It could be money. I mean, there are a variety of, it depends on the crime. In the terms of the violent offenders, it seems to me that what people who have worked in this mediation process, it seems that what they want most is that this offender understand what they did and they not do it again to somebody else.
Have you seen this in action yourself?
No, I've read stories about it. I know, and I've participated in some VORP, which is run by a Victim Offender Reconciliation Project. It's run by the Mennonites. And they are all over the nation. And I've done some workshops. But I myself have not, you know, seen it happen. Just read about numerous stories that are just amazing.
What are some of your favorite stories?
Well, I've told you about the woman in Texas. Several people have appeared on Oprah Winfrey and on Larry King. One was a woman, it was just amazing. Somebody had she was a victim of a hit. I don't understand the background, but a man shot her in the stomach. She managed to escape. 9 years later, the man calls her and apologizes to her. These two people now travel around to various prisons to speak to prisoners to get them to understand what they have done at their crimes. And I think that's the biggest...
That's incredible.
To me, that's the biggest part of this, that people not misunderstand this as something that is going to make us more crime-ridden by allowing people to come out of prison or to ask people to forgive, you know, something that's really very difficult to forgive, but more that it's a very concrete way to get public confidence in our criminal justice system again.
Of which there's not a whole lot. Don't we have the highest incarceration rate in the world?
Yeah, we have 2 million people in prison, and the recidivism rate is 66%. So restorative justice is really aiming at that, Colonel, to reduce the recidivism rate.
And what is its success so far in terms of that? I mean, has it been measured?
That's beyond my knowledge right now, Mary Charlotte, as far as measurements. I just, researcher at the University of Pennsylvania just did some work with victims who have been through the process, and she says that there is definite evidence that their post-trauma is much reduced by actually being in mediation with the victim, with the offender, excuse me.
Very interesting. Yeah. The development of empathy is something that I find very interesting, because it's actually a physiological thing that has to do with, you know, neural development in childhood. And when people don't develop empathy, have you seen that they're able to do so as adults?
That's an interesting question, because they're all out of sociopaths who are in prison. I haven't personally seen this.
We're talking to Helen Malanfi. Now, you also have taught courses on restorative justice. How do students respond to it?
Yeah, that's interesting. At the College of Santa Fe, we use a book called The Spiritual Roots of Restorative Justice, edited by a man named Michael Hadley from the University of Victoria. And what he did was to get various representatives from different religions, from the Sikhs to the Christians to the Muslims, to look at their literature and how religious groups have always written about how to restore. And all of them have this restorative principle in them, that they want to heal the community. They want to get some closure for the victim. They want the offender to understand what they've done. They want the community to be healed again, every one of them right through. So I've used that book at the College of Santa Fe, and there's lots of other, there are textbooks out now on restorative justice. There are, actually, I know someone here in Santa Fe who has her master's in restorative justice from James Madison University in Virginia. So it's very widespread. In 2000, a commission in the United States recognized it as a formal way to go about healing and crime prevention. The UN has endorsed it as an approach to crime. China has had two university studies. Recently, Costa Rica organized a conference throughout Latin America to look at this approach.
Is this something that liberals tend to be in favor of and conservatives tend to be against?
I really want to make that point, that this should be something that should unite us all. It's not a right-left thing, because the advocates of it argue that this is a better way. This is better than anything we're doing right now to reduce the amount of crime in the society. And to, that's the point. They feel that it's a better way than just pure, straight punishment warehousing.
In the straight punishment warehousing, one of the arguments in favor of it is that there is, when the punishment is severe, there's a deterrence. What
yes,
do you think about
true.
Deterrence? Is that
that's,
true?
That's one of the, I think,
I mean, when somebody is, I yeah. wonder about that, because if somebody says, if somebody's about to commit a violent crime, do they have the headspace to say, well, gosh, the deterrence is much higher than it was last year, I think I won't commit this crime?
I think one of the areas where we're definitely using deterrence is in the very high punishments we're giving for drug offenses.
But I mean,
if
then
you look at the
it just puts more people in, it just puts more
right.
people in jail. Does it deter
right.
crime, is what I'm asking.
It may in some cases and others not, but deterrence is a way, if you think about it, the people who advocate restorative justice say that's one of the least moral ways to approach punishment, because you're using one person to be an example, and you may make that very, very harsh, harsher than they deserve, in order to stop other people. A woman in New York State, for instance, was given 25 years for carrying $2,500 worth of cocaine to Albany. And there's a great book out about her experience because of the Rockefeller laws being so severe. So I would argue that the people behind restorative justice feel that's one of the almost not really good approaches to ethically to handle, that people should just get what they deserve in terms of a punishment, not using them to deter others.
How did you get into this whole line of work?
That's I almost fell into it. We moved to Dallas, Texas, and I got a job at a magnet school, a high school, where I became a teacher of criminal justice. And my father had been a New York City police lieutenant. And I said, oops, what happened? And I was in the middle of my PhD work at the University of Texas, Dallas. And the topic, I said to my professors, I'm teaching criminal justice, could I use this? And it was a history of ideas program. And they said, if you can work it around a history of ideas, sure. So with that, Texas was sued for cruel and unusual punishment in the early 1980s. A suit was brought, Ruiz versus Estelle. He was a Buddhist. He couldn't get his Buddhist materials. He sued and went all the way to the Supreme Court, Ruiz versus Estelle. And so between that and some materials I had on a journalist who...
What happened? He couldn't get his Buddhist materials.
They used to put him in solitary. They would go into his cell and tear up his stuff. And he went into solitary and he wrote the suit on toilet paper. And it went to the Supreme Court. And they ruled that Texas was in violation of the Eighth Amendment. It was a big, big case. And one of the first...
So he won?
Yes.
Did that have a ripple effect in terms of other religions and people being able to practice?
Absolutely. But beyond that, Texas was ruled in violation of medical services, building tender situations where there was a lot of violence by prisoner on prisoner, just all kinds of things. It upturned the whole prison system.
So that case. Very
so my dissertation was something like... Theories of punishment, that Texas prison system, and that's how, I really got into it.
So, the Texas prison system is notorious. It has changed to some extent. How is it
but
now?
But what's interesting, Mary Charlotte, is that it's in Texas where this violent crime mediation is taking place. And that's, isn't it interesting? I think sometimes where there's reputation for high death penalty in Texas, large prison system, rather harsh treatment, that it's in this state that victims have actually bonded together and had the victim advocacy.
And now
restorative justice, it's one of the biggest projects there. So I think that's very helpful.
We're talking to Helen Malamphy, and once again, she will be teaching a course at Ghost Ranch Santa Fe on restorative justice, and it's three Sundays in the month of October.
Yes.
And just a few hours each Sunday?
It's from 1 to... Lunch will be served at 12 o'clock, and then the workshop is from 1 to 3 for each of those three Sundays.
Give the people food and they will come.
We hope so.
Helen Malamphy is a professor of criminal justice at the College of Santa Fe and Santa Fe Community College. For more information on this upcoming workshop, people can call 982-8939. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It was very enjoyable to be with you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at the email address radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are also podcasting at the address santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to hear it, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes, where it will just show up in your iTunes every single day. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Hoedown. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Ciao.